The last panel today is about campaign finance reform. I'm the panel's moderator. My name is Michael Malbin. I'm executive director of the Campaign Finance Institute, which is a nonpartisan research institute affiliated with George Washington University. I'm also a professor of political science at State University of New York, Albany. The main speakers will be Curtis Ganz and Tom Mann, whom I'll introduce in a moment. A former California speaker named Jesse Unruh is well known for having said in the 1970s that money is the mother's milk of politics. Now, as the last panel of the day, some of you might be thinking more about caffeine than milk, but I'm going to say that that's appropriate because I'm sure this panel is going to keep you pepped up. The current federal campaign finance regime began with the Federal Election Campaign Act of 1971. There are remnants that go back to 1907 still in effect, but and many of the main parts were brought into law in 1974. The main elements include a disclosure regime, contribution limits for candidates and parties, partial public financing for presidential candidates in the primaries if they accept and abide by spending limits, which three of the main candidates did not last time. Full public funding for presidential candidates in the general election, again, if they accept spending limits, which John Kerry said yesterday he regrets having accepted. And then there are more recent changes. McCain-Feingold law, for example, most of the recent changes are about patching up some holes that had developed in the contribution limit and disclosure regimes. The main question for this panel is whether the state of democracy in this country is on balance better or worse off for having this regime of limits and disclosure. This debate will be carried forward by two distinguished speakers, Curtis Ganz and Tom Mann. First about Curtis Ganz, I think we all want to thank Kurt for putting together today's excellent series of thought-provoking panels. Kurt is presently director of the Center for the Study of American Electorate at the School of Public Affairs at American University. He's a research scholar here. Before that, he was co-founder and director of the predecessor organization, the Nonpartisan Committee for the Study of the American Electorate. He's an acknowledged expert on voter turnout and participation, and he's well known for leading the effort against the re-election of President Lyndon Johnson in 1967, and serving as staff director to the presidential campaign of Eugene McCarthy. He's written for many, many publications and has been a commentator on many media. Rather than introduce him separately, I'll introduce him both panelists now. Tom Mann is the W. Averill Harriman Chair and Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at Brookings Institution. Between 1987 and 1999, he was Director of Governmental Studies at Brookings, and before that, Executive Director of the American Political Science Association. Tom has taught at Princeton, Johns Hopkins, Georgetown, University of Virginia, and American University. His published works include Unsafe at Any Margin, Interpreting Congressional Elections, Vital Statistics on Congress, which is co-authored by someone who's on a predecessor panel, Norm Ornstein, and by me. And he's also the new Congress. He and Norm Ornstein have just completed a manuscript on Congress, The Broken Branch. He was also one of the leading people who commented on and helped develop the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act. Our procedure will be that Curtis Ganz will first address the question, is the system on the whole better off? And he has reservations, so he will go first. I think reservations probably putting mildly. And then Tom will respond. And then we'll go to a little interaction and then questions.
Well, I hate to disagree with a person who I think is one of the most thoughtful and pragmatic people in American politics and also one of the most decent. This year marks the 35th anniversary of the FECA, the first of a series of campaign finance reform act. You know, major ones were 1974, 1976, 1979, and 2002. Then we had about six others, you know, in the interim to fix small things. We've had two major Supreme Court decisions And one, I think, very important and negative in the 1990s advisory opinion of the Federal Election Commission. But the general thrust of all of this is to try to reduce the cost of campaigns, the influence of private money, in order to reduce corruption and the appearance of corruption. And I think now, because we've had Abramoff and Cunningham and Jefferson, because of the rise of the 527 independent organizations in the 2004 election, which was, bypassed the regulations on soft money, we had the breaking down of the presidential public finance system, due largely to front-loading and grouping of primaries, and we had, which makes the upfront cost prohibitive, and we have the general perception that the FEC is a toothless tiger. You're now in a situation where there is demand for more reform, but I think before we move in that direction or move in this particular type of direction of reform, we might evaluate what has been done against a few criteria, which I will get to in some detail. But has the reforms that we have done since 1971 reduced the amount of private money in campaigns? Has it reduced the involvement of interested groups in public policy formulation? Has it reduced or eliminated corruption or the appearance of corruption? Has it improved the quality of campaigns? Has it offered us better choices in the political marketplace? Has it left us with better public policy? Has it created greater accountability? Has it created a level playing field? And has the rhetoric used to justify these reforms helped with public confidence in the political process? And I would argue that the answer to every one of these questions, with one small caveat, is no. Have we reduced the amount of money in private money in political campaigns? In 1972, the year after the FECA, people spent $425 million total in all of our campaigns. The estimate for 2004 is $4.4 billion, or in constant dollars, five times what it was in 1972. Have we reduced the influence of the interested in the public policy formulation? There were, in 2000, 16,000 lobbyists in Washington. In 2005, there are 35,000. In 1998, according to federal records, people spent $1.4 billion on lobbying. In 2004, $2.1 billion. We have an estimated 100,000 people in the lobbying industry, 140,000 associations, and we are spending $4.9 million in lobbying per member of Congress. I think on the issue of corruption, Abramoff, Cunningham, Jefferson, legislators in Wisconsin, the likelihood of delay, and others speak to the question that we haven't much changed the issue of corruption or appearance of corruption, and we haven't done that because corruption is not a collective issue, it's an individual issue. It does not depend on campaign cash, it depends on personal character. And the majority of people in Congress have decent characters and there are a few bad apples. But you do not write legislation for the few bad apples. You do not create the equivalent of dealing with male adultery by abolishing women. Has the quality of campaigns gotten better? I don't think so. The cost of campaigns have increased, but also we have increased the level of scurrilous political advertising. There were $600 million spent on political advertising, almost all of which was negative, you know, in 18 states, you know, in the 2004 election. And what we are doing is poisoning the dialogue, denigrating any, you know, substantive debate, you know, about before the 2004 election, you could look at a Willie Horton ad or a little girl with the daisies ad. And those were the exceptions to the presidential campaign advertising. They were the rule, and they and worse were the rule, you know, for hundreds of ads in 2004. And the campaign finance regime, even with Stand By Your Ad, had no effect whatsoever. Are there better choices in the political marketplace? Would you want to represent supply-side economics by Steve Forbes, who can spend unlimited amounts of his own money, or by Jack Kemp, who couldn't afford to campaign because Steve Forbes couldn't contribute to his campaign? Would you prefer to have Ross Perot be the third-party candidate in 1996 or Colin Powell? Colin Powell couldn't get the money. Ross Perot could spend all of his. That's because of the limits. I ran, or was staff director of Eugene McCarthy's campaign. Prior to that, I organized the Dump Johnson movement and provided the theory with others and provided the theory for it. And when we got in a candidate, which was McCarthy, on November 30th of 1967, he was unknown to 57% of the American people. He stood at 2% in the polls 1 month before the New Hampshire primary in a universal climate that you couldn't beat a sitting president within his own party. And had we had to depend on $1,000 or $2,000 individual contributors or $5,000 PACs, we couldn't have done that campaign, and the American people would not have been given the choice on the war in Vietnam. Were we worse off when Duane Andrews financed Hubert Humphrey? When Herb Allen financed Birch Bayh? When Walter Shorenstein, financed Lyndon Johnson? Yes, in some of those cases, a office holder might have been beholden to one fat cat for one set of things. But he would not have to be beholden to all the interest groups in the country who may be contributing a moderate amount to campaigns. Do we have better public policy? I'm fond of asking the question, what do Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, welfare as we knew it, as opposed to as we know it, the Occupational Health and Safety Administration, the Council for Environmental Quality, the Environmental Protection Agency, the Clean Air, the Clean Water Act, the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, what do they have in common? What they have in common was they were all enacted at a time when people could give unlimited contributions, often in undisclosed brown paper bags. So much for the idea that public policy, major public policy, is driven by campaign cash. It is driven by leadership and consensus. Now, to elaborate a little bit, Wayne Morse was considered the great dissenter in our society, but he never took on the forestry industry. J. William Fulbright was probably the soundest voice in foreign affairs in the 1960s, but he never took on the issue of segregation. Lister Hill probably did more to bring the South into line for the benefit of education in this country, and he didn't take on segregation. We got the Civil Rights Bill in 1964 because Lyndon Johnson persuaded the minority leader of the U.S. Senate by the name of Everett Dirksen, you know, that he should vote for it, not because of its merits, but because we were building an edifice in Illinois in Dirksen's, you know, honor. That, you know, is not necessarily a dishonorable approach to American politics. We want to build, you know, we want to take people and build a consensus around them. I remember when I lived in San Francisco, there was a humor columnist by the name of Art Hoppe, but every now and then he wrote a serious column. And one of the serious columns was about his friend Jesse Unruh, and how Jesse Unruh first got into the state legislature and brought bag lunches and wouldn't meet with lobbyists or have lunch with them. And then all of a sudden he found himself being ineffective, and he met with the lobbyists and took their money. And Hoppe ended his column saying, I worry about my friend Jess Unruh. I worry that he will find the pursuit of power more intriguing than the judicious exercise. Well, he didn't. And an awful lot of people in the business of politics don't. They, you know, politics is an honorable profession for the vast majority of people. Are we more accountable? Well, this is the caveat. On one level, we are. We have more disclosure. But we have been moving money away from the accountable entity in the process. The only way you can deal with abuse of money is to not re-elect the candidate or not elect the candidate. But we have been moving money, you know, via limits away from the individual candidate, you know, to the political parties, and now, as you know, as of BIPRA, out to the most intransigent, non-responsible groups in our society, which are the 527 organization. You know, they help with the polarization. You know, politicians help often to bring it, you know, our country together. They are not the ones that, you know, they're the ones that are most limited in funds. How has this improved the ability of lawmakers to do their jobs? When people could raise large sums of money, they didn't have to be on the phone constantly to raise small sums of money. You know, most of the people who have to run for office, either incumbents or non-incumbents, have to spend the majority of their times in hotel rooms talking, you know, calling people for money, rather than spending times in the halls of Congress or with constituents dealing with public policy problems. Have we created a level playing field? The answer is no. What we have done is advantage the individual rich person who can contribute to the campaigns, who can run their own campaigns, people with access to large or moderate-sized contributors, and it's at the expense of the candidates who come from minority areas, who are poorer, who do not at this point have the seed money to get into the game. Are we better off for the rhetoric that has propelled campaign finance reform, that has vilified the system, that has talked about its corruption? You know, I believe the reformers are equally guilty for the cynicism in American politics, you know, as are the handful of people who are really corrupt. I think we need some reform, but I think we need to go in another direction. I think we need to get rid of the limits which are creating the distortions and inequalities, but I also think we need to subsidize, you know, at least through tax credits or public finance, you know, seed money for campaigns, and I think we need to deal with what is driving our campaign costs through the ceiling, which is televised political advertising. We are one of the only nations in the world that does not regulate televised political advertising, and I think we need to do that. If we enhance disclosure, get rid of the limits, provide subsidy, and deal with political advertising, I think we have a program that will do no harm as the program, as the road that we have been down so far. Thank you.
Tom Mann.
Thank you. I'm going to put Curtis down as neutral on campaign finance laws. How about the rest of you? I listened carefully to Curtis's discussion. I found myself resonating with parts of it, but here's what I think is going on, folks. One, Curtis sees some good old days, if not a golden age, at least better times. It's days of liberal fat cats, if you will. The Gene McCarthy candidacy in 68 is the chestnut of those who would advance a deregulated, unregulated system of campaign finance in America. And the stories about policies passed all seem to tilt toward a view of the role of government that would be favored by progressive liberal forces, and that in the end those causes were advanced when wealthy people with similar values could get behind candidates for the presidency or for whatever, and allow them to be free of the constraints of fundraising. A second thing in listening to Curtis that I detected was his belief that campaign finance is really important relative to everything else that drives our politics. And I suppose I would say that he's greatly overestimated the role of money in politics, that whether one is trying to understand the nature of partisan competition, whether one is trying to understand the conditions under which Medicare passes, under which, thinking ahead to the future, we are able to amend our social insurance programs to deal with the retirement of the boomers and increasing healthcare costs, has relatively little to do with campaign finance. And in fact, as I look through all of the questions that he asked, has campaign finance reform reduced the amount of private money, the role of interest groups, the level of corruption, has it improved the quality of campaigns, the choice of candidates, public policy, accountability, has it given us a level playing field? I say to myself, well, how could you possibly tell? As social scientists, we've got to figure out what forces are operating, what the broader context is, what other individual factors are operating to try to make some judgment about the role of campaign finance law. We also have to know what that law is. What are we really talking about in this case? There are laws passed by Congress, some parts of which are upheld by the courts and other parts which are ruled unconstitutional. There are administrative decisions taken by the FEC, and then there are the efforts of all of the players to try to cope with that ever-changing set of regulatory restrictions and opportunities, and it turns out it's pretty tricky to actually try to assess what the impact of the law has been. I think it's important to note that while Curtis has appropriately set this up as a kind of 35-year anniversary of the Federal Elections Campaign Act of 1971, that was by no means the first time American society decided there were problematics associated with the role of money in politics. That began early in the 19th century, and certainly after the Civil War, there began a series of reforms to try to deal with some of the very factors that Curtis came to praise. That is to say, the role of fat cats and large donors, the Mark Hannas of the world, and Teddy Roosevelt led such a campaign. The first important law after civil service reform was the Tillman Act of 1907, followed by the Federal Corrupt Campaign Practices Act of 1925. We have banned the involvement of corporations in our elections since 1907. Of unions and their treasuries since 1943. We have had spending limits. We have had expenditure limits throughout the 20th century. Of course, we had no reasonable mechanism for enforcing them, and so they were honored in the breach. But all of this suggests that the concerns about money in politics have been with us for a long, long time. It's partly a matter of the juxtaposition between our quest for political equality and the reality of economic inequality, and the concerns that money and moneyed interests can dominate our politics in ways that diminish the role of individual citizens. That's been a concern from the outset. We had generations of political scientists studying this, Louise Overacre, Alexander Hurd, Herb Alexander, and many of them would be sympathetic with much of what Curtis said. Skepticism about the efficacy on expenditure limits and contribution limits, and much more hope in the possibility of disclosure, transparency, public subsidies, and the rest. But interestingly, when the world began to change in many ways, in part away from money and politics, but just other transformations in the role of the mass media and the nature of our political parties and campaigning and consultants, other developments began to occur that led to another generation of political scientists saying, well, we ought to re-ask the question. We ought to see what's actually happening and see if there isn't some way of grappling with problems, new forms of problems that have arisen. Now, the other thing that I kept asking myself as I listened to Curtis was how's the campaign finance regulatory system is akin to saying how's your wife? The follow-up being compared to what? That is to say, what is the alternative to the system that we have now? Curtis says deregulate, disclose and provide public subsidies, where subsidies are floors, not ceilings. Disclosure is a little tricky because, of course, one of the battles of the last decade is what is campaign activity and what is to be disclosed, and what we learn that in order to get disclosure, you need elaborate regulatory regimes to define, well, is that only express advocacy that gets disclosed in this campaign activity, or is it something else? One of the things I found is that unlike Curtis, many of the people who really favor deregulation really believe it in a philosophical sense more than a practical sense, and haven't really gone through the exercise of asking how an American citizen using the marketplace, political marketplace, would discipline the role of money in politics. What do you do if Bill Gates gives, let's just say, $2 billion to each of the presidential candidates, and you're really offended by the, you know, the possibility of Bill Gates and Microsoft having some horrible influence on our politics? If he gives to both, how do you, the voter, somehow discipline that process? Well, you don't, because you don't really have alternatives, and you have other interests. You have ideology. You want to have a referendum on the performance of the government. The notion that somehow voters have it within their capacity to discipline the role of money in politics in a deregulated system fails when you start asking some simple, practical questions. Now, what I want to convey to you is not that Herb is asking, that Curtis is making sort of silly arguments about the problems associated with campaign finance regulation. It is god-awful. It is one of the most difficult arenas of public policy that one can imagine. The efforts to cope with the complexity of law, of constitutional rights, of actual practices, of the interest involved are enormous. But what I want you to know is that every other democracy in the world goes through this same argument. There are a limited set of tools in which to try to tame the downsides of money in politics. Disclosure, transparency. Number two, public subsidies. Three, spending limits. Four, contribution limits. And five, regulation of campaign activity. Curtis, as I understand him, thinks one is a good thing, that is disclosure, two is a good thing, public subsidies, and five, he's willing to enter into the arena of the regulation of campaign activity, in part by commandeering broadcast television and making available some opportunities for candidates. I find all three of those elements of all three of those perfectly attractive and plausible, but he believes that spending limits and contribution limits are inherently unworkable and end up doing more harm than good. All I would suggest is that the international experience suggests that some countries are more willing to do some things than others. In Britain, let's take Britain, for example, a great example. Back in the 19th century, they set up spending limits for their constituencies' elections that are still so small as to be shocking. But they didn't have any limits on the national party campaign where the action was, and therefore there was enough room in the system to operate. They provided some modest free TV for the parties, but they banned paid television advertising. They said, you cannot do that. In fact, many countries ban advertising that is paid for, bought by candidates or political parties. Others also have very restricted times of when you can campaign and the way in which you can campaign. I would suggest to you that the possibilities of doing that in this country are greatly constrained by the First Amendment, and therefore we're going to have to deal with other matters. Now, it turns out the Brits for a while live with that system, but over the last 20 years have been moving in part away for it. First, they set a national spending limit for the parties. And by the way, both parties were greatly relieved to have that spending limit because it stopped the arms race that had begun to develop. And they set up a system of disclosure. But then the disclosure turned out not to be quite adequate enough because in this latest round, it didn't include loans. And now they're all embarrassed and they want to improve the disclosure, but they're also now for the first time considering contribution limits in their system. But it turns out they have a real hard time raising enough money for their politics, and so they're going to have to look some more public subsidies as well. I could walk you through dozens of polities across the world in which everyone has tried to wrestle with this, and I will tell you, there is no iron law that contribution limits do no good and only harm, and that spending limits do no good and only harm. It's a complicated process, and I would suggest that if you actually go back through and ask sort of reasonable questions about how the law has worked in the last 30 or 40 years, what you'd come up with is a on the one hand, on the other, kind of assessment. Some aspects of FECA really work quite well. The disclosure system has worked exceedingly well. The individual contribution limits, unfortunately, weren't indexed for inflation and fell behind, and therefore it set other incentives at work. The presidential public financing system worked beautifully for almost two decades, and then fell out of date with the reality of what campaigns were costing, and unless it is repaired and dramatically reformed, it will be lost. And therefore, holding out the hope of public subsidies now as a substitute for other forms, when in fact the only real public finance system we have in place is about to collapse and die, is not a sort of very realistic thing in terms of looking to the future. That system that we had, the FECA system, for a while worked. It was tested by entrepreneurial politicians and parties, and before long we developed the so-called party soft money and sham issue advocacy, which was a way of getting beyond the restrictions on corporations and labor union treasury funding of our campaigns. That's what McCain-Feingold was about. Was it designed to reduce the amount of money in our politics? No. It was not designed to reduce the money in our politics, and therefore, Curtis, BICRA was not designed to reduce the amount of money in our campaigns. It had to do with the effects of elected officials and party officials being in a position to extract unlimited contributions from corporate CEOs, from labor unions and individuals, and use, in effect, the implicit threats of public policy to extract those funds. You know something that worked really well? That part of the law worked really well, as did the effort to keep union and corporate treasury funding out of electioneering campaigns. That's what the reform was about. For the most part, it succeeded. 527s are a fairly minor part of the picture of campaign finance. They were in 2004 relative to candidates and parties. Does this system work well? No. We've done incremental reform. When we tried more comprehensive, much of it was thrown out by the courts. Their efforts now to repair this system, to take some steps that would genuinely improve the competitiveness of our elections. They're a tough haul, a tough sell, but you really come back to what, and I'll conclude with this, come back to what your expectations are. Are you realistically prepared to say anything goes, that is to return to a state of nature in our campaigns? The Commonwealth of Virginia and sort of one or two small countries have done it, but almost no one else around the world is prepared to live with that system. We know there are unintended consequences that we have to worry about. We know that there are enormous political obstacles in pushing forward with the competitiveness enhancing elements of election reform, but I see little evidence that unlimited contributions would advantage challengers in a system. I see no evidence than a couple of anecdotes about rich people supporting individual candidates at one time or another. In other words, if you think the present system is so bad and that it's really driven, the problematics in American politics are driven by the regulation of campaign finance, then you're ready to go for broke and say, let's deregulate this baby and try something else. But otherwise, you're forced into the very unglamorous world of monitoring, maintenance, and repair, like we amend securities law and other forms of regulation, of sort of keeping after it, of trying to do the best we can, of seeing new problems develop, of trying to make a proper trade-off so there's adequate money in politics for candidates, voters, groups, parties to participate actively. I don't think we spend too much money in politics in our elections, given the size and diversity of our country, but I think there are all kind of problems associated with how it's raised, how it's distributed, and that means sort of constant efforts to try to make an inadequate, unacceptable system a little better, because the alternatives are even worse. Thank you.
Last time, we'll have a brief reply by Curtis, and I have something I want to put on the table for comment, and then we'll go to you.
The first thing I want to say is, we did separate ourselves from the Brits at one point, and I don't think they need to be our model. As far as the great macrocosm of American politics is concerned, I definitely agree with you that campaign finance is not the central problem. Although the amount of effort that people put into the campaign finance reform would indicate that they thought it was. I continue to believe that the questions that I ask are central. That the current regime of putting on limits undermines every one of those, that we do not have the flexibility in our system, once you impose those limits, to make major and substantive changes in our politics, that we disadvantage particularly minorities in terms of the type of fundraising they are allowed to do under the present system, that we don't have adequate enough disclosure, and that we can do something about the media that is not giving dollops of free time, which I don't think is workable. I have always advocated, as in another generation, Warren Rudman, Dan Inouye, Wendell Ford, Jack Danforth, Fritz Hollings, Terry Sanford, Bennett Johnson, amongst others, that the way to deal with the political advertising problem is to A, encourage longer segments, as Doug Bailey suggested this morning, but for shorter segments, that you require the purchaser of the ad, which would be candidates, parties, and independent expenditure groups, or an identified spokesperson, to speak to the camera for the duration of the ad. Essentially, you allow people to buy whatever time you want to say whatever you want to, but you return it to speech and accountability and reduce the impulse to use ads as the basic staple of campaigns. And I have to say that the civil liberties and constitutional community is divided on that, but it's not unanimously against or even necessarily a majority against. What I'm trying to have is a system. Once we know, as we do know, that it is not how much the candidate with the most money has, but whether the candidate with the lesser amount of money has enough to get their message across, that is determinative of winning, then I don't care about spending limits, and I don't care about contribution limits. I do care about defining union treasuries and corporate treasuries as a person. I think we don't want that. But as far as union, contributions to their membership or the creation of PACs, I'm in favor of that for both, corporations and unions, so long as the money is voluntarily given. I want a system that has the maximum amount of flexibility, the maximum amount of possibility, and the maximum amount of opportunity, and the least downside in terms of how we conduct our campaigns and, propel our, monetary politics upward.
Thank you. I want to pose an issue to both of you. It's the second half of what I take to be the question of the panel. The question of the panel was, is the country, on the whole, better off for the laws that have been put in place? And as it's worded, I would say if worse, but let me take that out because I would say whether you think it's worse or not, maybe if you think it's better. Nevertheless, the second part of the question is what are the next steps? And that's what I want to ask about and focus on. I, at the risk of oversimplifying, I would put the dispute that we've just heard as being about the following question. Are the bad side effects of contribution limits, on the whole, causing more harm? Is it worse having them than the good effects of not having office holders ask for and receive unlimited contributions? And that's a dispute, and we've heard both sides of that dispute. I want to move on to the other part of the question, because the next question then becomes whether you agree, whichever side you take on that, if you believe that the country is worse off for having contribution limits, is the next appropriate step to fight to repeal them? Is that the most important item on the agenda? If you think they're good, is the most important item on the agenda to tighten up whatever loopholes might exist to make sure they work even better or really well? Or is it time to think about a new paradigm, to think about new questions, to think about new goals? And I think that Curtis's second half of his agenda really points in that direction. And there may be more common ground in this discussion than we're aware of or than we normally hear. For example, I think most people who support contribution limits, including myself, would agree that contribution limits, even at their best if they work well, can only take you so far. And eventually, what they're really about is preventing bad things. And Curtis is suggesting that they are, worse things happen because of them. I don't think anybody would argue that by themselves, limits end up producing the kind of democracy, strengthens democracy in the way that we would like. They don't produce participation by people. They don't produce participation by small donors. They don't produce stronger challengers. So the question is whether whether people who are on both sides of this debate about limits really ought to be thinking and concentrating about how to get, let's say, how to strengthen challengers. Curtis has already suggested ideas there. I think Tom has implicitly or explicitly agreed with some of them. And whether we ought to be thinking about how you get more small donors in, how you start not worrying about equalizing by not thinking you can get to the point of equalizing just by putting limits there, but actually one needs to promote participation by smaller players, whether through tax credits, whether through multiple matching systems, various ways that one can use through public policy to stimulate small donors. Now, again, I don't think it's appropriate or useful to debate the precise mechanism, although we have come out with several recommendations. The real question is whether it's time to be asked, whether people want to be asking different questions about improving democracy and improving democratic participation, as opposed to trying to cure some of the ills. I'd like either of you, who wants to start with that? That's my comment or question.
Well, I like the framing of that. In fact, I said it much less gracefully by talking about the sort of dual agenda. One is sort of repair and maintenance of an existing system that has, in many respects, been designed to avoid bad things. But the other side of it is a positive agenda that really tries to deal with the need to get more money into places and more resources to into elections where there is no sign of competition. And you know, political scientists oftentimes argue, well, that's what political parties are for, but sadly, and I'm a great fan of political parties, and they thrive, by the way, in the post-Bikra world, the post-McCain-Feingold world, but they have, in recent years, because of the parity between them nationally, so concentrated their resources on a handful of districts that they have abdicated their responsibility for extending the playing field, and I'm frankly looking for ways of trying to encourage them to spread their resources more widely. For example, one of the policies I include is one that was added to the 527 bill, which is to remove the limits on what parties can spend in coordination with their candidates. Take off the limits altogether. You're limiting the input side, the contribution. There's no soft money; it's all hard money. Why not free parties? To do that, if they did, their spending would be more efficient, and they may feel they have an opportunity to spread those resources more broadly. I also favor seed money for challengers in the sense that up to a certain level of funding allow larger contributions to come into those candidates to try to improve it. But I want to keep it within a regulatory system where there are limits. I also was greatly heartened by the development in the last election cycle with respect to small donors, and I think a good deal of thinking, some already done by the Campaign Finance Institute, about how to move that along, encourage it, tax credits for small donors, tying it into a revamped presidential public financing system, are all really good ideas. And there are other forms of public subsidies that would work to elevate the visibility of challengers and be very healthy for the system. So my response to your question, Mike, is I would neither repeal contribution limits nor tighten them. In fact, I would loosen them. I would loosen contribution limits, but I would look for a more affirmative agenda to accomplish some positive good in the system.
First thing I want to say is that over the years, Mike Malvern has been one of the most thoughtful people in campaign finance field. I'm sorry, Mike Malvern has been one of the most thoughtful people in the campaign finance field. And he's one of the few Republicans that actually believes, in public finance. And the only... I want to issue a caveat, as I did to Mike in another hearing, about the finding that the parties were not necessarily hurt by BICRA. They weren't in 2004. But what we do not know is whether they would be hurt in an election that was not driven by the emotional polarization created by George Bush. We do not know that, and I think the jury is out as to whether the parties will or will not be hurt. On the broader question, I do, there are things, which Tom, just was in favor of that I agree with. I mean, I am for seed money. I actually, my formula is, you can ascertain, how much was spent on the average in cost-adjusted dollars in jurisdictions. And if you meet a certain petition threshold, you ought to be able to have a subsidy of one half of it. To go into it. I tend to favor that more than matching because it's a political criteria rather than a monetary criteria. But I do think we need another paradigm, and the other paradigm is without limits, or with $100,000 limits, or not $2,000 limits. We need something to make it possible for people to make change, and we need to deal with the worst aspects of our present system, which is our media use. Those are the things I think that are very important. Yes, we want subsidy. Yes, but I think we need a different paradigm than limits, and I think we need a different focus than just simply money. You tell me which does more damage to our political system, somebody like Michael Huffington running and losing, or $600 million spent on scurrilous advertising in 18 states? And the answer is $600 million in scurrilous advertising in 18 states. That is, that type of thing is killing our system. Michael Huffington is irrelevant.
Yeah, but Michael Huffington is perfectly compatible with the current law. That is, the Supreme Court has said individuals cannot be limited in the amount of money they spend out of their own resources for their own campaigns, and most of them waste a lot of money doing that. That is, most self-financed candidates fall flat because they don't have the other qualities that that really are needed. Individuals also have the right to spend unlimited sums out of their own resources on independent expenditures. It's only when it becomes a sort of collective activity, when money goes to political committees, that they fall within the regulatory regime. So we still have a lot of safety valves in our system, whereby if we think, quote, wealthy people are and fat cats are the way to change public policy, to break through, to help an underdog, then those actually exist through independent expenditures and through self-financed candidates. Just one other point on the parties. Of course, you're right. We'll never know over the long run what the impact was. And yes, 2004 was a very unique, highly charged election year. But 2006 is one as well, and the parties are ahead of their pace. Before that is it's continuing into their success is continuing into a midterm election, and I bet you 2008 will be just as contested and emotional as 2004. You come to a point where people get used to contributing on the internet, where parties have set up mechanisms to raise this money, and my best guess would be we will never have to fall back on raising, $1 or $5 or $10 million from a corporation or a wealthy individual for parties to do their work, that parties have adapted. The biggest champion of this new system, by the way, is Terry McAuliffe, who was the master at extracting large soft money contributions. He thinks it's the healthiest thing that has ever happened to political parties, and he believes they will thrive in the future.
Terry McAuliffe is the person that gave us, the primary system for the last election, decided on Boston as a place for a convention. He was by far and away the worst, chairman of the Democratic Party in my lifetime.
Yeah, I feel like John McLaughlin as the clock is beginning to run down.
Let me just, two small points. Three small.
Sure,
points.
But I want to make
one. One is, that, I agree. I didn't think of it in my last one, but I do agree on, you know, on the coordination issue that, you know, that would be an improvement. I don't think, you know, money for an independent expenditure or money for a self-financed candidate is the same thing as providing adequate money for a Gene McCarthy or a Jack Kemp. You know, our flexibility of our political system needs Jack Kemps and Gene McCarthys. You know, and under present law, they cannot run because they don't have the wherewithal.
I do want to make one point. I was hoping that I would make a deal here. We're not going to make a deal. However, my perspective is, whatever one's position on limits, this was a good election. There are a lot of good campaign finance stories in the 2004 election. The number of people who contributed to presidential candidates and parties went up from less than 0.5% of the population to roughly 1.5%, which means that 98.5% still do not contribute. They don't contribute $5, $10. I believe that there's a lot that you can do outside of this argument over limits that can help persuade people to participate. And there are experiments going on in the states and localities using tax credits, rebates, vouchers, and multiple matching systems such as four for one for the first 100 or for the first $50 rather than one for ones, that are worth pursuing, because I think the goals are not only about candidates, they're not only about competition, they are most importantly about the role of people in the democracy. Having said that, we have 2 minutes and there's time for that many questions before we have to vacate the room, so let's right in the front. Speak loud. There's a microphone coming down the aisle.
Hi. I wanted to ask you a little more specifically about McCain-Feingold. And to that end, what do you think the most difficult parts of McCain-Feingold have been to enforce, and how would you address those problems?
That's for Tom.
The question is, the most difficult parts of McCain-Feingold
to enforce.
I suppose what supporters of McCain-Feingold would point to would be the increase in the number of so-called 527 organizations, that is, those organized as political committees with the Internal Revenue Service that are designed to influence the outcome of federal elections but do not register with the FEC and abide by federal election campaign law, because they say they are spending only independently of candidates, and therefore there should be no restrictions on what they do. They're making no contributions to candidates whatsoever, and they are not taking money, some of them say this, from corporations and unions, those who engage in electioneering communications, the media fund, television advertising, the Club for Growth, the Swift Boat Vets. And their argument is, because they're spending independently, they're not taking corporate and union funds, they should not be forced to register with the FEC. Those like America Coming Together that are involved in Get Out the Vote efforts have accepted union contributions, and the argument is that's perfectly legitimate, because their efforts are both federal and non-federal, and they can allocate the hard and soft money as they choose. I think critics would say that was an end run around the efforts, and that is why you have seen advocates of McCain-Feingold file suit in the courts. They've gotten the FEC to reconsider some of the regulations that they've issued, while you've had legislative efforts on Capitol Hill to define what a political committee is in order to put it in a better position to know and to be required to register by with the Federal Election Commission. My own sort of personal view is that this is an important issue, well worth some attention, but it's probably an issue that whose time was 2004. That is, what people were mainly exercised about were the very fat cats that Curtis is talking about, the George Soroses and the Peter Lewises, who gave not a million but $24, $26, $28 million. And it turns out they don't think they got their money's worth, so they're shopping for other ways to participate in public affairs and politics and governance, and so it might take care of itself.
The answer to your question is that Roman and Littlefield, in about a week, is publishing the book, the Campaign Finance Institute book, called The Election After Reform, Money, Politics, and the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act. So until it comes out, the whole book is on www.campaignfinanceinstitute.org. The 527 dispute, even those who think they're a problem would acknowledge that it's a dispute that's grown for 20 years out of the original law and not out of the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act. The actual enforcement issues of the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act are rather narrow. It's not that ambitious a law in the first place. The questions about it are about side effects, not necessarily enforcement issues. They're about political side effects. But I think there are other questions. I see a microphone, and I know we're going to have to.
Yeah, we've heard two different perspectives on campaign finance reform, but I believe there's another one. I think what is wrong with a completely publicly financed system, which combines the FCC requiring public broadcasters to set aside enough air time for the candidates to get out their views for debates, since the public the airwaves are actually the public domain.
Basically, like the presidential general election system extended to other
offices. Yeah, just a totally publicly financed.
In theory, that's a nice idea. In practice, in theory, it probably will not come about until your grandchildren are dead. In practice, it doesn't work. Which is to say, I don't think constitutionally you can prohibit independent expenditures. So you can publicly finance, all the campaign, but there will be this money outside of here, that will be spent. And do you want, money going out there, or do you want money going to the candidates? So that's one question. The other thing is, in theory, I would love, free television time. Allocated television. But that works much better in a parliamentary system where you have one spokesman for all the people, spokesperson for all the people, who are being elected for that party. In this country, we have a candidate-oriented system. You can go into a New York media market and have, four parties, 20 congressional races, three Senate races, two governor's races. How are you going to allocate that time in any meaningful fashion unless they're cattle shows. And you have primaries and generals. Primaries would even create a worse situation. That's why, one of the reasons why I don't advocate, free time. I'd love, the Harvard proposal of 5 minutes of issued debate, for the last 8 weeks and, once a week on network television. But I don't think that's, enormously important. But I do think, that we have to go at
the political advertising question and the dialogue question another way, which is why I'm suggesting we need to create an incentive system for longer ads and we need to regulate shorter ones.
I think there are creative ways of getting free and subsidized airtime to candidates. There are proposals for broadcast banks and trading systems and giving parties control to allocate to candidates that where it would be spent at the state and local level where campaigns actually exist. We tend to focus on the presidential, but there are ways of doing this. But I agree with Kurt's first point that I think you can never have a fully publicly financed system. Money will be spent outside. I think the First Amendment guarantees it. I also think there's some value in some market testing of candidates and the ability to go out and raise money. I especially like small donations is a healthy part of our politics. The sort of final thing, just to know that there's not full agreement, Kurt believes that the form of television advertising is what's at the root of many of our problems. Therefore, looking for ways of changing that, thinking longer formats and others will really improve that. I'm just more skeptical of that. I'm inclined to let the marketplace work here more. And frankly, I think broadcast television is going to be old hat pretty soon. I think we're already moving to more emphasis on direct voter contact, get out the vote. I see the internet as gaining importance in the future. And so in some ways, we shouldn't get caught on television advertising because its era may be passing.
Yeah, and for the last word of the day, we turn it back to our host, Curtis Gantz.
2 points on that. One, you know, Ken Goldstein made it very clear in his remarks that despite all these, you know, talk about internet and online fundraising and cable and satellite, the overwhelming majority of money in the 2004 campaign was spent in major increments over the 2000 campaign in political advertising. So I do think that that's a major problem that needs to be addressed, both in terms of the quality of our campaigns as well as the question of cost. I want to thank Michael. I want to thank Tom. I want to thank all of you hardy souls that stayed here for a long time. Particularly you two over there, and a little bit for Nancy. I want to thank C-SPAN. I want to thank Becky and Marilee and anybody else who helped. We will do this again, and I will be a better advanced person. Thanks again.